The views expressed in the following program are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the Key Biscayne Independent or Miami 4th Estate. Portions were pre-recorded.
And again, I think of how I think of you, and I want to love you. She will always be my friend, though.
Live from Key Biscayne, Florida, this is Antisocial, the podcast that takes the swirling winds of social media and tries to make them calm. I'm Tony Winton.
And I'm Jan Dillow, filling in for the vacationing John Pacenti.
Well, welcome, Jan.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back.
I'm so glad you could come back and help us out today.
No problem.
What did you do for Halloween?
I went to a friend's house and we gave out candy on Glen Ridge. We went through, she had a couple of people because she needs backup, and we gave out hundreds of dollars at least of candy to these people, to these hordes of kids.
Contributing to dental decay all over the island of Key Biscayne. Listen, all the dentists out there, see what we're doing for you? Okay.
But it was a lot less than it was on a week. When it's a weekend night, you can't see from one side of the street to the other.
Yeah, it was pretty jammed. They actually closed down part of Glen Ridge there. Just as it really turned into, we brought.
Well, they always do.
Yeah, right? Story about it. It was just forget it. No way you could get past. Right. What did you? What did you dress as?
A pickleball player.
Oh, I thought you were going to say CFO.
Yeah.
No. Because that, since you're our CFO of Miami 4th Estate.
Well, I could have been that.
That would have been the scariest costume you could have worn.
Yeah, exactly. Well, to tell you the truth, all I was doing was wearing like a skirt with the shorts underneath it. So.
Well, you know, a great time was had by
all. Yes, it was.
But speaking of times and whether they're good or bad and hard things that may be scary or not scary. We have a guest in the studio today who's going to be talking about a very large project that, at least for some people, I guess, feels kind of scary because of the dollars involved. His name is Steve Williamson, the village manager of Key Biscayne.
Known welcome, to all.
Yes, welcome to our show. Mr. Williamson, you're on.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Tony. I didn't know you were turning it over to me.
Yeah.
It's great to be here. Great to be here on this week of Halloween. And what you guys were talking about before is what makes Key Biscayne such a wonderful place to work and be a part of.
Well, just before Halloween, and the reason I was talking about our that little theme there is because you had a very detailed workshop meeting with AECOM, the village's contractor that is looking at ways of moving this project forward to the next phase, you know, getting some consensus from the village council and the leadership on what they want to do. And there were two kind of dominant questions, I guess, areas that came out. A lot of it's focusing about the cost of this project. You know, we had a number from AECOM, including a contingency, let's be clear about that, pretty large, I think 35%, right? Yeah, to make sure there was no overruns, like biggest, highest number you could come with, somewhere in the $310 million range. And of course, this is aimed at seeing if that number can be reduced somewhat. And so council member Brett Moss, who has been somewhat critical of some of the aspects of the program, put his idea about the criteria or the goals this way, and I'll just play the clip and you'll hear a sense of where he's coming from.
I keep going back to the idea of living in the north of the snow. It snows, you can't go outside. You have to wait until they plow it. Sometimes it takes a day. You're stranded, you stay home, you figure it out, right? So the thing is, do you spend hundreds of millions of dollars so that it's always dry, even in the worst case scenario? Or do you look at, let's look at the common storms we get, take care of those first, and then we look at the worst case scenario and say, what can we live with and what can we not live with?
Right. And so council member Fernando Vasquez, who a former executive AECOM and now, worked in that field, saying, kind of responding a little bit, saying, you know, he wants to worry about where the models are going in the future.
So is that 7 inches a proper projection for future generations to come? Are we looking at today's data? You're looking at a 1999 curve. but we're designing for 2060. So, and this is more of a public and for council.
And allow me just 1 second.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, it's just that I agree, and I don't disagree that we should try to minimize the cost, and we should try to be as thorough as we can. But I don't want to keep our eye off the future, and because we're not designing for the past, we're designing for the future.
Right. So two kind of polar ideas there. One, that Key Biscayne, we have to get used to flooding to a certain degree, and the other one saying we don't know how bad the flooding is going to get. Right. So how is what you're doing and this workshop you're going to have for the whole village, how are you addressing that for the public?
Oh, thank you, Tony. And I think you see the discussion that we're having in kind of the, I don't want to call them polar because it's not necessarily polar. It's just, different opinions and different thoughts that are bringing us together, which I think we're going to optimize where we're trying to go. But before we start, and I want to read this, make sure that anyone who's listening here today really understands what we're trying to achieve with the Resilient Infrastructure and Adaptation Program. And I'm going to read this word for word because I think it's important for people to understand.
Okay.
And we're trying to protect residents, their property, and their quality of life from impending environmental changes. And in many cases, those that we don't quite know at this time. And what we want to do is to build a stronger, more resilient community. And so I want to make sure that we always go back to that and understand that it's about people, it's about property, it's about their life. So we don't want to do this without getting community input. And this process from, if you all the way go back to February of last year, when we first presented the level of service, we've now been a year and a half in. I think it's really important before we kick off on a major investment that we bring those diverging opinions to the middle. And I think what you've seen from the August discussion workshop and the October workshop is that ability to ask those questions and begin to optimize the level of service, the parameters, what storm we're going to use, what sea level rise projections we're going to use. And we slowly move towards that. And what I think was the most important thing out of coming out of last meeting was the direction that we are going to give to AECOM, which the council will officially do on November 14th council meeting to move forward with that additional modeling.
So let's take that back in stages a little bit. So the you mentioned, I think it was in February of last year, the council voted 7-0 to set this level of service. And I know that's a term that maybe some people is maybe a little, it's itself a little not always completely understood, but it's basically a combination of what models you're using to predict the future. You know, for sea level rise, it's the NOAA Intermediate High model. And also, how much water in the streets are you essentially going to deal with?
Exactly.
And that level of service was fairly aggressive. I don't know if you'd call it a Cadillac plan, but it was a fairly aggressive plan that said the amount is really pretty minimal. We're gonna assume a maximum storm that would dump 8 inches of rain. It's going to be able to clear it, I think, within 6 hours, if not mistaken.
6 to 12 hours.
Yeah, six to 12. And then the ponding that would happen would be confined to the swales, would keep basically the road surfaces dry. But that came in with a big dollar sign, right?
It did. But I think, look, when you ask somebody, you know, with no other context, do you want dry streets? The answer is going to be, of course I want dry streets. And what comes to their mind is, when it rains, I don't have dry streets. And that's part of the problem, is that we don't have a stormwater system that works right now. So what they're imagining is the 15 or so, maybe 20 times a year that they face flooding. So what we're trying to do is take away those days and only make them the days that are extremely intense rainstorms. You know, similar to what Councilmember Moss said about the snow. Sure, can we accept rain periodically? Yes. Can we accept a certain amount in the road? Of course we can. We're trying to optimize, get to that amount that is acceptable. And I think the conversation of, would you like to have the Cadillac, as you said, or would you like to have dry roads? You're always going to get yes. But now when you put a price tag on it, we're coming to the middle on exactly what do you want and at what cost.
How much give is there in this number, though? I mean, you have to tear up the streets for, you know, pumping it clear in 6 hours or 12 hours or 24. You're still going to have to tear the streets up. You're still going to have to put a new pipe. You're still going to have new outfalls, right, no matter what. So yes. At some point, you know, what's really changing? The diameter of the pipe, the size, I mean, how much wiggle room really is there?
That's a great question, Tony. Right. So yeah, right. We're going to have to dig up the road anyway. So the labor cost is generally speaking going to be the same no matter what choice we do. I mean, maybe you can move that 5%, you know, back and forth, but it really isn't going to change by much more than 5%. The pipe costs, you know, the difference between a 36-inch pipe, a 48-inch pipe really is not significant. But what does have a very significant difference in cost is the pumps. And how many pumps you need, what the capacity of the pump, and how do you discharge that into the bay. That's where the cost comes in. And that is where you ask the question, how much water do we want to move off our roads and how fast do we want that to go? So that's where that really becomes a part of the equation.
One of the things that I've been hearing is that you're talking about going from looking at projections from 2060 to 2040. And I have a question about that because, you know, by the time it's built, you know, it's, you know, right now that's 17 years from now, but by the time it's built, it's maybe 15. So that becomes a question. And, you know, are we building for, you know, 10 years or should we just go ahead and do it? So it also begs the question, can you, once you put these in, if it's a matter, what the real cost is in the pumps themselves, can you wait for, can you upgrade those pumps without doing the roads? So could we do it now with this pumps for 2040 and then in 2040, just replace the pumps with a bigger pump and you don't have to dig up everything again?
That's a great question. It really is. And, you know, I think, what we actually gave and the direction we're going to give to AECOM is actually 2045
okay.
and 2060 to look at those two-step approach. And it is still with the idea of having 2060 in mind. So we're not taking 2060 off the table, but we're asking the question, what can you do to help reduce the flooding at 2045? Creating infrastructure then is expandable. In this case, the biggest expansion would be to add pumps. You don't want to replace the pump. You would, let's say, for okay. instance, have two pumps, and let's say you need 50% more capacity. You would then add in a third pump, and that cost would then move you to the 2060 requirement.
That makes a lot of sense. But how long would it take you? I'm sorry, but how long would it take you? I mean, you're saying, say we're looking at 2045. How long realistically is it going to take? And I know that we've been talking about this already for years, but how long would it take to build it in the first place? Like if, is it 2026? Is it 2025? Or
so I like that Tony had you ask that question, not him. I knew that question was coming. But anyway, you're trying to pin me to time.
Yeah, it's you know, good cop, bad cop. What can I tell you? All right,
she's going to be the bad cop tonight. But anyway, look, this is something that we want to get right. There, I think we've identified, and folks know that we're looking at 8 zones throughout the village. We've chosen zone 1, which is that area right around the K-8 school, because it is the one that's most impacted by flooding and also has the biggest impact on the ability to move, right? Obviously, that's where our kids go.
It's where I take all the flood pictures that you see in the Key Biscayne Independent. They're all from that zone.
It is where it floods. I mean, there's a reason why we picked that, right? Question again.
How long?
Tony threw me off. I imagine I'm out there in the rain taking pictures.
That's what we're doing, yeah.
How long?
No, how long? I know. I was just kidding on that. But I was just having this vision of Tony in the rain taking pictures. But
his little rain boots.
So we want to get it right. So, I mean, how do you get that right? First, we have to do the proper modeling to get us towards what do we want to design towards. And I think we're going to get there. We're going to give AECOM some very good guidance coming out of the 14th of November. My goal, my intent is to bring the final directive to AECOM on the January council meeting to give them direction to go to 30 to 100% design. That should take approximately a year to be done. That would be, let's just say, end of 2024. Then you go through, and it's going to have to be a very robust and detailed procurement process. This is not something you want to do off the cuff. This is going to have to be a contract that this village, procurement process and contract that this village has never done. The expertise, which is one of the reasons why we have Black and Veatch.
And that's about to get
manager,
to that. Right.
Is the specialty on how do you put that type of procurement together.
Right.
That'll take, to do it right, at least 4 months. You're going to want to have the specifications. You're going to bring these folks in. You want to talk to them. Do they have the capability as a contractor? Do they have the right subcontractors? Because this is very special work. So those are folks that we're going to have to bring in. And I would imagine that may even take 6 months, 4 to 6 months for that contract to be approved. And then construction, I would imagine it would be about a year, year and a half to get done. So we're looking at, add that up, mid-2025.
So you, yeah, you start mid-2025 and you finish at the end of 2026.
Yeah. And, but also we're going to learn a lot by this process, and we will already be starting on zone two or the second zone. It may not be zone two itself, but the second zone that we'll be tackling. So you know, the more we learn, the faster we'll be able to go. So we'll be able to move these through much quicker.
Right. But you also have another issue, and this has come up and it's in our story. Another big cost driver are easements. Right. And whether you can, the number of them that you can secure, the more that you get and the spots that you need them, the less the cost is, right? Because you have to dig less and pipe less, if I understand that correctly.
Yes. Look, we have, right now we have 17 outfalls. Obviously we have those are existing easements, and most of them are side yard easements in existing property. We'll use those. Where we can find more, where people doing construction go in and have a negotiation. And we just had one that was approved with no cost whatsoever. We'll hope that people are out there going to have their civic duty, civic pride, and say, sure, if it doesn't affect my way to do my construction, affect my yard, then certainly the village can have access to the side yard. Where we may experience some costs or maybe some time is the concept of the dissipator, where you actually have a side yard pipe that doesn't impact their ability to build, but then it actually turns, you know, a right angle across the seawall, and where it actually dissipates the water so you don't go scouring into the bay itself. You know, we'll see where that goes and how many people will accommodate us for that.
Right. So that's a potential.
That's an unknown. But, you know, I know there are a lot of people in this village stepping forward and offering their easements, understanding that whether there's an existing one or maybe there needs to be a new one, you take your 10 to 15 feet, you give me what I need, I think that's a fair deal.
We'll break in a little bit, but I did want to try and get a bigger picture if I can, because a lot of this is going to be about the stormwater system, but there are other components of this plan, the utility undergrounding, the coastal protection. Do we have any kind of bigger number or kind of overall idea what taxpayers will be funding with all these other things? Obviously, the village has been very assiduous working with the Army Corps and Miami-Dade County to try and get enrolled in the Coastal Protection Program. That's a long administrative process, right? There are a lot of parallel tracks going at the same time. But at some day, right, there is going to be additional costs. So what is the best kind of number?
Money and time.
Yeah.
Money and time. How do I know is you can ask that, Tony? Yeah. You already got me on the time one, so money.
No, Jed got you on the time one.
Well, I know. You passed it off to her, but I saw the way that's coming. Now you're surrounding me. But anyway, so look, you've seen the estimate. You know, we're probably talking between $250 million to $350 million all in when it comes to stormwater, undergrounding utilities, improving our roadways. I think the cost that you've seen with AECOM is about $300 million. And that's with a 35 plus or minus percent contingency. I'm giving us a range between, I think we can bring that number down. That's why we're going to give this direction. And so I'm moving towards that 250, but I think we all have to be ready for this to be somewhere between 250 and 350. But that's the big picture, right? That's the whole village. And just to make that kind of detailed estimate right now is getting way, way ahead of ourselves, because what we really need to do is focus in on zone one and understand zone one.
Right.
And you see right now, AECOM is suggesting it's going to cost about $35 million for the stormwater part. What we've gotten from AT&T, Comcast, and FPL is approximately a $3 million undergrounding cost inside that. So if you are to take that 35% contingency is correct, add $3 million on top of 35, then we're looking at a cost of approximately $38 million for zone one.
I know Mayor Rasko was hoping that contingency hopefully not need every dollar of it and apply that to undergrounding, for example.
No, look, I mean, AECOM is a very professional organization, and before they're going to make a concrete cost estimate, they're going to go through all this modeling that they are. It's not fair to say right now, so what is it actually going to cost? And there's a term, I can't remember what it is, and I think you heard Rowan say it's the CCCP. I know it got it wrong.
That CCNA or something like
no,
that.
No, it's not CCNA.
You guys with your acronyms are driving me crazy.
But it's the most probable cost, right? So that's the most softest cost estimate as one can have, because they're still in planning and modeling, so which is why they give them a 35% contingency. As we give them more and more details to model, they're going to get closer to the cost. And my expectation is, come January, that number will be closer to reality. And so that exactly what we're trying to do is, you build a zone one, you're telling us it's 35 million, stormwater only. We want to know, how do you optimize performance, time, and cost to get us to the right number?
I have a question about the cost, because we're focusing on what we're going to get as a bid, and that's the cost that we're looking at. I'm just wondering, because I've never heard this spoken of in the past, but aren't there some offsets? Don't we, you as a community, pay for different things related to stormwater mitigation or whatever, you know, whatever we're talking about, or, you know, outages for electricity? Is there a component there in our budgeting process, or is there a way that you can cut out some of the costs? So I guess I'm just trying to say, is there any netting force here?
I wish there were. Okay. I don't think there are. I mean, I think for the community there will be, right? Okay. For the public, from the government, no. But I think people will experience fewer flood damage.
Okay.
Fewer.
But we don't really pay anything for any of those things now.
Well, I would imagine those that have experienced flood damage have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Insurance ratings.
Insurance rates will go down.
Okay.
Property values should remain stable and or go up. And everyone's looking at coastal communities and value of properties. And I think those communities that aren't doing anything, those values are going to go down. Those that are doing something, they're either going to maintain or they're going to increase. So we're not doing this for any benefit for the
I think for the
community, there's a huge amount of benefit.
We have so many more questions for you, right, but we also know you have limited time. We'll be back with a lightning round where the manager is going to tell you how he's going to solve every single problem in Key Biscayne. And we're going to do that right after this. And we are back on Antisocial. I'm Tony Winton.
I'm Jan Gillow.
And we have as our guest the village manager of Key Biscayne, Steve Williamson. And, you know, during the break, there was a frenetic conversation that I really wasn't listening to. But I know that you have a pre-question, so shoot.
Well, Tony, before we start, can I say something before
you
we start?
You absolutely can.
There is nothing like the lightning round. Lightning round at 4:30 on a Friday afternoon. So bring it on. Let's go.
We should have brought him a coffee. We have
lightning shots. We'll do that later. All right.
There you go.
Yeah. No, it was more of a clarification. I was just saying, you know, I went for a walk on the beach, and there's been a lot of damage, basically. And we had no rain. It's all the wind. And it looks like a lot of sand has probably gone in the last few days. And I was just wondering if there's a budget item. That's why I was asking if there were any offsets.
No, I'm glad you asked that. Look, we had, you know, surprisingly so, since neither Hurricane Ian nor Hurricane Nicole hit us directly during when those hurricanes occurred, we received some significant impact from those storms. When Ian went through Southwest Florida, it actually went across the state, pushed out in the Atlantic Ocean, and we had some back surge. You know, I think it was the time when we had eight foot,
right,
you know,
surfboards.
Waves in Key Biscayne. It was amazing. But we lost a lot of sand as a result of it. You know, very, very hard work got us funding in the Florida state budget. Our representative Vicky Lopez and Senator Claudiude got us another additional $450,000. Well, we're going to put, the bid is already out. We're about ready to select a firm to come in the, I guess it would be March, April, May timeframe to actually rebuild the beach. So we've got that on the list, and we're going to get that going come springtime.
All right. Time for the lightning round. Number one, Bear Cut Bridge. Go.
Bear Cut Bridge. We just got notification from the county. So the rehab, the 10-year rehab required by FDOT, should be kicking off in the next 30 days. That will address the existing maintenance and repair requirements that keep that bridge as a functional bridge. Second part of Bear Cut Bridge, moving towards replacement. There's what's called a planning development environmental study that has to be done before they go into design. That will be awarded, I've heard, by the county in December. That will be a three-year study, which will have complete engagement with all stakeholders. And we have one of our staff members, Director Jeremy Kios-Gauger, as one of the technical review committee members. And so Key Biscayne will be a significant part of that process.
Rickenbacker Causeway.
Rickenbacker Causeway. Look at that. You guys are coming at me. So Rickenbacker Causeway.
exactly.
Nothing like asking me what other people are doing for us. But, you know, the good news is that we've really established great relationships. And I think that's one of the things that I've tried to do since I've been here. And, you know, coming from working elsewhere in the county, I think we've been able to build those relationships and maintain those relationships because we are an island. And with one road in, one road out. And if we are not working with those stakeholders, we can't get done what we need to do to support our residents. So Rickenbacker Causeway. Again, Jeremy is also a part of the master planning effort with the county. They've chosen a firm to move forward. It's Kimley Horn, a firm that we worked with before. They got awarded in either was July or August, and that master plan is moving forward. We are about 3 months in, so I really can't say where we are or where we're going, but the good news is that it's moving. That will be an open process once it gets to a certain point. And again, we'll bring back to the community and get their input.
So one of the things that I've heard about that is that the planning stage could take 2 to 3 years. I've read this from the Virginia Advisory Board that the planning could take 2 to 3 years, the design 4 years. So that looks like maybe we're talking about 2030. Does that sound?
Or Rickenbacker Causeway?
Yeah, for actual construction.
I don't want to predict that. Again, I'm not, and Jeremy's the one who's working that closely. The thing is that, yes, we need to get, first we got to get a plan. This is similar to what we were talking about the resilient infrastructure program. Everybody wants to see things move, but everybody wants their part of the solution to be part of the solution. Mm-hmm. So,
and I've heard nothing about financing any of this. Is it just assumed it's just going to be tolls? Is there, after this thing is developed, do they then go back and say, do we try a privatization again? Is that dead?
Well, no, look, I think all options are probably on the table, and I'm using probably because, again, it's not our project, it's the county's project. They have extended the master plan. It's actually going all the way to the underline. So it's going to go from Bear Cup Bridge to the underline. Certainly we have a causeway that makes about $13 million a year. The money is there. Do we need to increase it? Do we not need to increase it? Someone will do the financial analysis. The good news is that when you do have a revenue stream, you can actually use a revenue bond. So how they're going to finance that, how they're going to do that, that's going to be part of the master plan as well.
Right. And I know, the Secretary of Transportation was here. Pete Buttigieg was here. And we did ask him while he was here about the Rickenbacker Causeway. And Mayor Levine Kavas said that was on her list of many asks for the Department of Transportation. There is funding that apparently it's a very complicated thing whenever you're dealing with government funding. But apparently there might be a window of opportunity there, but at least get some recovery of that from the feds. So who knows?
Yeah, look, and I think what's important for everyone to know, you are not at the federal table until you do your PD&E study, your planning development environmental study. That is a NEPA requirement, an Environmental Protection Agency requirement that must be done in order for you to be competitive for a federal grant.
Right, and it's already in work.
It should be awarded in December.
Right, yes. But I mean the funding for the...
Yes, for the study.
Yes, it's there. All right, last part of the lightning round.
Well, I think we got two parts.
Okay, two parts, okay.
The two-part question.
Yeah, the village did a really excellent job this week doing a condominium owners forum with Vicky Lopez and Raquel Regalado and insurance representatives and somebody from the county. So you guys did a great job bringing everybody together. And I think we all really appreciate that. And we'd like to see another one about insurance. But
anyway. Although I think you could have used the little 5-minute timer for the village council meetings there to some of the presenters, just a little point.
Well, they are politicians, but, can you give us an update on the certifications, for the buildings? I think there's 38, right?
38. Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for recognizing that. Cause that was a lot of hard work to put that together. We brought the idea back in August. We talked about ourselves amongst ourselves. We talked to the commissioner's office. We talked to the representative's office, and we really wanted to ask the questions: what do we believe that our residents need and want? And here we are, 2.5 years later, after Surfside, the collapse at Surfside. We've learned so much since then. not only have we learned so much, people are now actually paying attention to it. What do we do about taking care of our buildings? How do we certify? How do we make sure that the boards that we elect to run our condominiums can do what they're supposed to do? And then how do we address this thing called insurance in Florida, which is coming at us in ways that I don't think we have ever seen before? So we really wanted to bring those folks together. And yes, we do plan to do another insurance, another separate individual insurance symposium sometime in the February, March timeframe. So more to follow on that. So how are we doing? So I think you heard me say on Wednesday night when the collapse at Champlain Towers happened back in June of 2021, I literally was on the job for a little bit more than a month. And that was a great learning experience. And the good news is I had a building official of Rene Velasco and his caliber and his talent. We spent hours and hours and hours and time and time and time gathering the records that we had in all of our buildings, putting together so that we could clearly understand the status of our buildings. Were they in damage? Were they not in damage? And the good news is, were they in danger? Were they not in danger? And the good news is none of our buildings were in danger, but many of them have not gone through their certification, recertification requirements. What we did is we put a very detailed process in place of our 38 buildings that require it. 15 are all the way done, completely certified. The other, do the math, what would that be? 23 are in the worst case through the permitting process. The other one's in plans review. The other ones are actually about to move into construction. So good news between, the government working with our condo associations, we are very well off in Key Biscayne.
Is that information available for everybody? Is that available on the website or anywhere?
I don't think we have a separate website that lists that, but we do have a nice little chart that I see every 2 weeks that I'd be happy to make available.
Yeah. Okay, I think that'd be helpful.
That gives exactly what stage and what phase they are in terms of completion.
Right. One question that was came up in that meeting had to deal with the financial requirements that condo associations are going to now have to adhere to starting in 2025, particularly when it comes to reserves. Do you have any sense or feel for how buildings in Key Biscayne, these 38 buildings, how many of them are current with the reserves, or are we looking at a tsunami of very large assessments for buildings? Because, you're talking about, I'm a homeowner in a condo. I've got this big public works project out there. We have everything else happening in the economy, and I may also have a mammoth catch up on compliance with the reserves that are necessary.
We don't keep those numbers. Obviously, we talk to our condo boards and associations frequently. I would imagine they would bring up if they're facing some financial difficulties, particularly if they have some sort of construction coming up. Most of our condos have managed their funding and management well. Others, I think, are learning. I hope all of them are going to be in position when it comes, but we're here to help when they need the village to assist them when it comes to the certification requirements and what we're responsible for doing.
Right. But it could be even earlier. There's talk of going to 25 years, right?
Well, but, I think they said that it was going to be 30, didn't they?
Yeah.
No, well, I mean,
or
I think
it could change, I guess.
Yeah, you heard Eddie Rojas from the county said they are really deliberating that they think it's going to be 25.
Oh, okay.
They don't know. I mean, it's still 30. That's where they're targeting 30, but it could be 25. And we've already identified that we would have 10 buildings that would move into the process earlier as a result of that. So we've already been communicating with those buildings. We've been letting them know that your certification could be earlier than what you're anticipating.
And as a village, you're responsible for monitoring their compliance with the certifications, but are you guys responsible for any other information on reserves or working with them with their CERS certification? And maybe you want to explain what that is?
No, our responsibility is to ensure that they're going through the building certification process. When it comes to how the condo associations are run, their reserves, their finances, that is a state requirement.
Right.
There's a state agency that does that. That's their business. We don't want to add another layer of confusion into that. But yes, we are the ones who help municipalities, help condo associations work their way through the certification process. But again, it also goes back on the responsibility of that board and the structure engineer that they hire.
All right. Steve Williamson, we could keep you here another 2 hours of questions, but I do want to give you one final chance to plug the big meeting. So
the big meeting,
the workshop, right? You're asking the community to come in on the resilience.
Oh, yes. The big meeting.
This is your sales job.
I thought this was like the big pumpkin. Wasn't that like Charlie Brown's big pumpkin or something like that? That brings back some memories, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So,
I didn't ask you what you dressed up for Halloween as. You could have done that.
Yeah. I was a turtle.
Okay. Oh, wow. Turtle.
Yeah. You know, okay. I wear it every year. So I kind of, you know, this year I wore a red, bandana, red hat, and that's Franklin for those who know. I didn't know that, but that was something you've got to change this year. Put a red hat on and a bandana. So I now have a plan every year. I'll wear the same costume, but I'll wear different accessories. Makes it easy. But anyway, question. So the big meeting.
The big meeting.
As you know.
And about the big dig. I know you don't like that term, but yes. Yeah, okay.
My uncle was involved in the big dig, and you know he's lost a lot of hair. I want to keep my hair. So as you know, we've been going through a process there where we started back in August, where we had the initial workshop with the council, where we talked about the big picture. They gave us guidance. We had one-on-ones with the council to better understand the direction they want to go in. We brought that information back a week and a half ago for another council workshop so that we could tell them what we've done and get further direction that we can move forward on with council. Both of those meetings were open to the public. There wasn't a intent to have a whole lot of public engagement because it really was an opportunity for the council to give us their guidance.
And it was really technical, I have to
say.
It was.
And it's hard stuff. But what we are doing, in fact, Chief Resiliency Officer Roland Samimi and I were actually looking at the presentation today. We are going to bring on November 8th, next Wednesday, a presentation on how does that village-wide approach, the 8 zones of what we need to do from stormwater, roadways, utility undergrounding, what does that look like? And then very specifically narrow in on zone 1 about cost, time, what kind of performance do they expect? What is the balance between cost and performance? And then what level of disruption is acceptable to them? So this is going to be an opportunity for them to ask questions, understand what we're trying to do. And if we find out that it's too technical, we'll do it again.
Right. November 8th.
November 8th.
Time?
6 o'clock.
Location?
Community center.
Okay.
The lighthouse room.
The lighthouse room. Okay. So now you have all the information you need to know. This is where you're going to get a chance to hear from the village officials, ask questions, interact, try to, you know, convey this. And it has a lot of moving parts. It's not an easy thing to digest. So,
and Steve, I want to plug that our engineers will be there too. For those who are very technically minded, because I know there are many, many, many very well talented engineers here on Key Biscayne. We'll also have our engineers there to talk to those who want to go into more detail.
Yeah, gallons per minute, whatever it is, you can get into every stat you want.
Yes, you can.
Better than baseball. Steve Williamson, manager of the Village of Key Biscayne, thank you for coming to Antisocial.
Well, thank you both, and have a great day, Tony.
All right, take care, and we will be back right after this. Key Biscayne, island paradise. Key Biscayne. And we are back on Antisocial. I'm Tony Winton.
And I'm Jan Dillo.
And our guest, Steve Williamson, is still going over his charts because he's wondering if we forgot to say something. But he will be a guest on the show again. Get your reaction to all of this information that we're getting here. Is it overwhelming? I mean, or, you know, how do you
I think
sort it for yourself?
I mean, there's a lot of information. I think it's hard to sort of sort some of it through because I think, you know, honestly, I come from a corporate background, so I kind of try and think in corporate terms, and things are very different when you're talking about municipalities because I always look at the numbers and I forget about the grants and all these kinds of things. So for me, it's there's a lot of information, but you're right. There's a lot to be done.
Yeah. There's also the background, and we try to report this a little bit in our story, is we are looking at the history of of sea level rise. He's now leaving a room. Sea level rise and the future of sea level rise, right? And those are models. They're exactly. very complex climatological models. You can look at past data and say, well, this is kind of a very flat line kind of stuff. But in reality, or what the science community is saying is, the evidence is pretty strong for this pretty accelerated path increasing in intensity as the outer years come along. So, you know, the environment of 2040 is a very different environment from the environment of 2060. And that's what you're trying to capture in modeling.
Right. And I think this year, especially, you know, with the warming of the water here in Florida and you know, the broad kill off, die off of corals, which wasn't something that was really on our radar before. So I think that's one of the things that, you know, that climate change
unprecedented
teaches you.
Hot waters right. all over the Atlantic.
But it's also one of those things that about, climate change, it's, you can't model everything. You know, it's hard to model everything because this has never happened before. And sometimes the thing that you haven't modeled is really important. So, it's hard to make those kinds of projections out to 2060. I mean, there's conversations that say that the heating of the water will change the currents. And if the currents change, then that changes, you know, that could have implications for sea level.
Absolutely. Cause it changes everything else in the system. It's an ecosystem and all these aspects interact with each other.
Right. And when you're talking about engineering, you know, you're building something and it's, you know, you want it to be there for a while. So it is very difficult when you've got those kinds of variabilities.
Well, now that we have all those problems of the world settled, maybe time to talk about something a little bit lighter, at least my social media feed, at least the last couple of days. And because, you know, it's part of my generation and was about this. The Beatles, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
You know, the lads from Liverpool, back with an album out in 2020, or the song out in 2023, Now and Then.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. But we're talking about a single that was just released.
Today.
By the surviving members of, one might argue, the greatest band of all time.
Yeah.
And a song that is available because of artificial intelligence, AI. I found some old recording that Yoko Ono had on a cassette somewhere. Great. And they were able to lift the vocals out and then marry them with, you know, modern instruments and then take this song and give it new life. And it just sounds, it's the Beatles.
Yeah. It totally is. It must be a little bittersweet, you know, I think for them to, you know, or just an odd feeling to hear yourself, you know, something you did 50 or more years ago, right?
Yeah, especially with members who've passed and particularly, yeah. you know, that song was written by John Lennon.
Yeah.
You know, and it made me kind of sentimental about the day he was shot. You know, that was a student at Columbia University and, you know, heard this news breaking on the news station there, 10-10 Winds, and John Lennon had been shot. And so, you know, the whole city just kind of gravitated, a lot of people gravitated to the Dakota, the building he was shot outside of. And, you know, it brought back all of those memories, all flooded back about how the world lost such a talented person.
Yeah, I think there was just such a collective sense of mourning at that period. It was just, I remember being just, you know, so, you know, just shocked. Who could do that to John Lennon? But before we moved here, we lived in the Upper West Side, which is, you know, where the Dakota is. And we would go into the park at Strawberry Fields, which was
Strawberry Fields. Yeah. So, but the happy news is we have another song and taking you instantly back to some of the great melodies and the creativity of that group. And that's a blessing that came from this new technology, AI. So a lot of scary things about AI that you read about, But this was kind of a really cool thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my social media. What have you been? What have you been doing?
Well, I guess recently, since we just got the news like yesterday that Sam Bankman-Fried was arrested or was convicted on all counts of fraud, was definitely in my feeds, and the amount of ire and anger coming towards him is so palpable, and yet he seemed like. For so long, like when he, I guess it's been a year now, he just didn't seem like he understood that all the anger that was, you know, aimed at him in some ways. But anyway, he's convicted of all of it, and I think he's got another trial now coming up next year for this one was for fraud, and I think that one's for I'm not sure.
Is it a case? Do you think it's a case of a person who just didn't think the rules applied to them?
You know, I kind of do. I mean, I don't know. It seems like he's got that kind of a personality where he just didn't connect and he just didn't understand. And so that might have been part of it. You know, the rules don't apply to me because I've always been able to figure. I've always been the smartest guy in the room. Maybe the Enron thing. I don't know. But and I guess the other thing that I was noticing in my feed is.
Oh, you texted me about this.
Yes.
One. Yes, you did. And we have a reporter. We got the reporter right on it.
Yeah, we should do a coverage of this because on at the Marine Stadium, there is going to be a pickleball games event in January of this year.
Is that like the Hunger Games?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay. Okay.
It'll be very slow people.
I'm sorry. I just find the whole word pickleball just makes me like, I don't know. I know it's a thing.
I know. I can't do it. I mean, a friend of mine has gotten me into trying it, and I'm terrible because I do not have good eye-hand coordination, but it is
you told me you got trounced
thing.
By the mayor, Mayor Asco.
Oh, well, I'm a beginner, first of all.
Okay.
But he is he doesn't move very quickly, but if you get the ball anywhere near him, he kills it.
Wow.
So he's definitely good.
So kind of like deceptively, you know, you might underestimate him. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but it's hard when you're playing with me and you don't move because I hit the ball.
Well, you should know that we are working on the pickleball story, and okay. That takes me into our last final segment here, which is about the upcoming stories in the Independent. We do have some pretty intense coverage, and we will be continuing it on local crime front. I don't want to get into the over details about the story, but it involved a situation involving the police officers and the Department of Children and Families. We will continue to follow that story, as well as the continuing coverage of this story from our guest today, Steve Williamson, the Resilient Infrastructure and Adaptation Program, or as we call it, the Big Dig. We have those stories coming up, but also coming up, and as the chief financial officer of Miami 4th Estate, we have Give Miami Day.
Yes, the Give Miami Day is a very important day throughout Florida for nonprofits such as ours who, you know, do what they do in a number of different areas, but do what they do really to make this a better make this a better community and a better place. Miami-Dade. And broadly, but a better place to live. And I'm sure everybody has heard a lot about this already. But for us at the Key Biscayne Independent, we do rely on donations.
On your generosity, folks. If you're listening to this program and you like hearing, bringing in the top guests, asking the tough questions, getting information out, there's a cost to all of that.
And particularly this year, as we've grown and added, added a specific reporter to cover many of our areas, those things, cost money. And we hope that you will remember us. The Giving Day, Giving Day is actually the 16th, but donations can begin as early as the 13th.
Yes, for Give Miami Day the 13th. And of course, it's also the entire period. Let's want to remember, we have matching funds, so your funds are doubled right now if you're listening to us. Hey, I can do that now. You can wait till the Give Miami Day period. You can do it now. Your funds, whatever you give to us during the season, will be doubled through a national program called Newsmatch. So that's also important
to
know.
From November 1st to December 31st.
To the end of the year, right. So
up to $15,000, right?
Yeah, so we get a big boost from that. So now is the time. Please, your generosity is deeply appreciated. It lets us continue to do the kind of quality journalism and move to our expansion. And we do have plans to expand into other communities. We discuss them all the time. We have other communities approaching us wanting to do the same kind of quality journalism that we do here in Key Biscayne. So your investment in local news is an investment in democracy at the local level. And it's so appreciated. And we ask you to do that. And we will give you one of these for every dollar that comes in.
It's our tax deductible.
And they're tax deductible. Jan Dillo, actually, we should do that again because thank you for co-hosting today. Didn't Jan do a great job? Yes.
Thanks.
That's it for me. I just want to, again, thank our guest, Steve Williamson, who's continually running for so many meetings, for coming on to the Antisocial Program, and for the vacationing John Pacenti. Be safe, everybody.
The bear.